morning, everyone. We'll call the meeting to order 9:16. And before I turn it over to Carter, I'd just like to welcome our newest commissioner, Commissioner Bill Jones. Appreciate you being here. Commissioner Jones has a long and distinguished history of service to this state, and certainly has a passion for all the things that that we're interested in and that we're entrusted with. So it's great to have you. We're lucky to have you and appreciate it.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it.
It's good to be here.
And we'll go ahead with public notice, Mr. Smith.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chairman. Public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official records of the meeting. I also just real quickly want to acknowledge we've got a new court reporter, and she's joining us for the first time, Paige Watts, right over there diligently taking notes. I don't want to interrupt her too much. She's with the firm Sunbelt Reporting. We're delighted to have her here with us. Just as she's taking notes on the stenograph, I just would remind everybody, if y'all would remember to speak in the microphone, that would help her a lot in terms of being able to pick up everything said so she can have that documented. So, Ms. Watts, welcome. All of us look forward to working with you. So, thanks for being here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now I'll call the Regulations Committee meeting to order. First order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes from the August 24, 2011 meeting, which have already been distributed. Do I have a motion for approval? Moved by Commissioner Scott.
Second
by Commissioner Hickson. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you. Committee item number two is an update on permits to control protected wildlife causing depredation. Layton Wolf. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Yeah. Okay, I got ahead of myself. Committee item one, which is our update on progress in implementing the land and water plan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. I'm gonna pass out a handout first. Let me just pass this around. One of the things that we do on an annual basis is Ross puts together a stocking report of all that our Inland and Coastal and Wildlife Divisions have done with respect to stocking fish and game in our state's lands and waters. And I think you're going to find it's a fascinating report. There's a long and rich history of the department being involved in stocking game to help provide opportunities for our hunters and anglers. And there's a little bit of history here that I think also for some of the newer commissioners that I think you will enjoy reading, going back to the 20s when the department started stocking turkey around the state, and in the 30s deer, and all of the trapping on the King Ranch that went in that populated so many parts of the state with deer. Inland Fisheries been doing this since the 40s. Of course, coastal fisheries and all of the great work on stocking our bays with redfish over time. You know, I think it's something like 600 million fingerlings in the last 30 or 40 years. So a lot of that history. This report also, in addition to giving you that and kind of a snapshot of what all we did in 2011 with respect to stocking game, also gives you a little bit of sense of kind of priorities going forward. And so, for instance, on coastal fisheries, y'all are aware that, you know, we're looking at trying to shift some of our efforts to help be in a position to stock more spotted sea trout. We're also looking at how we expand our flounder stocking effort, still very much in its formative stages, but our team has done a great job on that. Inland is certainly holding steady, been doing a great job, obviously, with the Florida largemouth bass. I do think it's important to note, too, particularly this time of drought, that water for our hatcheries to continue our fish production is likely to be more limited in the future. And so that's going to impact our ability to do more on our winter trout stocking programs around the state. That's a very, very popular program in communities around the state. And just depending on what happens with the drought, our hatchery production, particularly on the inland side, may be significantly impaired depending on water availability. So I just want to forecast that. On the wildlife side, we've got plans to go back and trap bighorn sheep up in the Baylor and Beach Mountains and the Diablos, and look at some additional stocking there at Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, but also Big Bend Ranch State Park. And so, we're looking at this, at least for the short term, as potentially being, you know, the last stocking of sheep at Black Gap for the short term. And we've had a lot of success there. We've had a lot of success with this initial stocking of sheep there at Big Bend Ranch State Park. As y'all will recall, I think we stocked 46. I'm looking at Mitch Lockwood for confirmation. I see a gentle nodding of the head, yes. And so I think my numbers are mostly right, Mitch. And thankfully, really, we hadn't had a lot of mortality with those sheep. We've had a few line kills out there at Big Bend Ranch, which is kind of to be expected, but not a lot. Also, you know, our biologists put satellite transmitters on those sheep, and, you know, they were doing what we long expected them to do, which is some of those sheep are moving back and forth between Mexico. So, you know, that speaks to the importance of having kind of a binational look at the habitat on both sides of the river there. So, again, that stocking report, I hope you find useful. Ross put that together working with our divisions, and if you got any questions on that going forward, please do visit with him, and hopefully you'll enjoy reading through that. The other item that I want to report on, and this is a matter that gained some notoriety in September with the sentencing of a deer breeder in Cherokee County that had been the subject of literally a four-year investigation of this individual knowingly and willingly smuggling, you know, 37 deer from multiple states into Texas. So knowingly and really wantonly violating the state laws against smuggling live deer into the state and then selling those animals and animals that had been in pens with those animals to other breeders without those breeders knowing what was going on. And so, you know, this individual knowingly exposed other deer breeders to risk, also, you know, potentially in bringing deer in from out of state, created the potential where, you know, wild deer could have been exposed to diseases that we're concerned about and trying to keep outside of our borders, like TB and chronic wasting disease. And our special ops team did a great job working on this. Convicted under the Lacey Act. It's a very, very high bar for someone to receive a Lacey Act violation. I mean, that's the most egregious and most significant of wildlife violations. And so this individual was formally sentenced in September, had to pay a $1 million fine to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, also a $500,000 in restitution to Parks and Wildlife, which we've distributed out to various programs, and also had to forfeit a lot of his stock, really all of his stock of frozen semen straws that he still had remaining. So, you know, I want y'all to know we still take this directive very, very seriously to do everything we can to protect our borders. Our special operations team is working very, very hard to catch and apprehend people that are trying to just brazenly violate those laws, and in doing so put our wild game at risk, but also other breeders that are unknowingly purchasing deer from someone taking those risks. So wanted to share that with you and give you that report, commissioners, and if you've got any questions, I'll be happy to answer any of them.
Any questions?
Thanks,
Carter.
Appreciate it. Item 2, update on permits to control protected wildlife causing depredation. Now we're ready for you, Clayton. How are you?
Doing well.
Good.
Mr. Chairman and commissioners, for the record, my name is Clayton Wolf, and I'm the director of the Wildlife Division. And this morning I'm going to give a brief presentation to you on depredation permits. That's permits to control wildlife that would otherwise be protected by the Parks and Wildlife Code for numerous purposes. But specifically this morning, my presentation is going to focus on crop depredation and permits that we issue for depredation of agricultural, commercial agricultural crops, and even specifically depredation on these crops that is being caused by white-tailed deer. For the benefit of some of our newer commissioners, and as a refresher, I think I need to provide a little bit of history. Back in 2004, the agency was receiving quite a few complaints about crop depredation, primarily up in the San Angelo area and primarily on cotton. And so for several years, we had a series of meetings. We were called up into the area by elected officials and by farmers to explain the statutes that govern depredation permits and how we administered those permits. Folks weren't necessarily pleased with the way we were administering those permits, and there were several major points But one of those is the process at that time prior to 2009 was cumbersome. An individual actually couldn't apply directly to the department. They had to go through the county judge or the mayor, and oftentimes the judge or the mayor, they weren't quite sure why they were even involved in this process. This process required that our biologists go out and assess the damage and confirm the damage out there and then make recommendations to alleviate that damage. But most importantly, the applicant had to certify that they had implemented our recommendations before we could issue a permit. And just simply put, for 99% of the cases, our recommendation was the construction of a high fence. Our biologists feel like really the only long-term solution to crop depredation is to erect a high fence at the interface of rangeland and cropland to keep the deer out, and then at that point, any deer that get in or that remain on the cropland side, we would issue a permit for. Now, those recommendations weren't necessarily well received by a lot of farmers out there. During that time, there were certain market things going on. The price of steel was going up, fencing prices were going up, profit margins for farmers was going down. So nonetheless, there was still quite a bit of consternation and displeasure with our recommendations. So at that time, Representative Scott Campbell was a representative out of the San Angelo area. He asked that we implement a pilot program in Tom Green County only. And the sum and substance of that was to dispense with the high fence recommendation and just let's see what happens if we don't recommend a high fence and we issue permits. However, we only got two participants, and I'll report some of the harvest or the kill data on this a little bit later, but it still wasn't, we didn't receive a lot of reception and only issued two permits. By April of 2008, Representative Drew Darby was the state representative up there who had inherited this issue. At his request, we held a meeting in Wall, Texas, and basically did a one-stop shop for permit issuance. We brought in the county judge. We solicited, with the help of Representative Darby, brought in a lot of farmers, and we, in that process, issued 25 permits, an attempt to get a lot of permits out there and just monitor and see what would happen as a result of that. It was not that effective. And at that point, then individuals started really blaming carcass utilization as a barrier as opposed to receiving the permit. Because then and now, the statute just do require that the carcass be kept in edible condition and then donated to a needy individual or charitable organization. So in 2008, I pulled together a deer depredation working group, and we met in Lewaukee, Texas. Commissioner Duggins came to that meeting up there and enjoyed a steak with us at the famous Lewaukee Steakhouse. And as a result, we compiled recommendations from the working group. We provided those to Representative Darby, and he and Senator Seliger co-authored House Bill 1965. That was enacted in 2009, and then on the heels of that, at our August commission meeting in Fort Worth, this commission adopted new rules associated with the program. The major changes at that time from the statutes and the regs was that the county judge and mayor were removed from the process and the applicant could apply directly to us. We were given rulemaking authority, which we previously did not have. We maintain status quo for species such as pronghorn, bighorn, and mule deer. But the big change was that the applicant did not have to implement recommendations necessarily. And for whitetail deer purposes only, the process was expedited. We are actually required to issue the permit in 10 days. Our staff is still notified. Our staff in all cases right now is still notified. And we have held up at least one permit. But the bottom line is we do not make a high fence recommendation in most cases, and the permit is expedited and goes out the door, and then we monitor. So I'm going to show you a series of slides from 2005 to 2011, and the format of the slides is all the same. The green counties that are highlighted are the counties that receive crop depredation permits, and the number inside that county is the number of permits they receive, and then the total deer taken is in the top left. The other colored counties, those are our public safety permits. Those are basically permits to airports that we issue, and the kill on those from those permits is negligible. So in 2005, we had those two permittees that we signed up through our pilot program, and they killed six deer. In 2006, we actually dropped down to one permittee in Tom Green County, and that one permittee killed 14 deer. And in 2007, we had one permittee that killed 32 deer. If you remember 2008, then that's when we did our second phase. We signed up 25 permittees, and they reported killing 109 whitetail deer in Tom Green County. And then in 2009, that's when the statutes and the regs changed, and you'll see that we issued permits over a much broader area. 35 in total is what you have on your screen, 35 crop depredation permits in total. And in 2009, those permittees reported taking 305 whitetail deer. And we did have one permit out there in Pecos County for mule deer, and we used our conventional protocol. It was basically a vineyard that had a high fence around it and a hole in it. And so the applicant had to first fix the hole and then also made an attempt to run as many animals out as possible. And then after that point, we issued a permit to take the rest of the animals that they couldn't get out of there. So that was our normal process. But for the rest of these, no high fence recommendations. In 2010, the permit numbers went down to 23. Remember, 2010, we had a little bit more moisture out there, and that seems to be the pattern. When we have drier years, we have more crop depredation problems or complaints. And those 23 permittees to date report killing 256 deer. Now, the permitting or the permits are valid for a full year, and so all of those permits have yet to expire. And so we would probably get a few more reports, but I suspect this is probably the bulk of the kill for 2010. And in 2011, of course, we have no harvest reports that are required at this point, but the number of permits that we've issued is 41, which is the most we've ever issued. So we probably anticipated this a little bit with the drought that we're in. And a lot of depredation on irrigated crops, but like you can see in Tom Green County, not many permits because dryland cotton didn't even come up. And so where the permits are issued moves around a little bit. If we look at a summary of reported kill for those reports that are already due to us and have been turned in for 2009 and 2010, you'll see the majority of the recipients report killing no animals. And then as you see on the chart there, 10 of them reported killing 1 to 5, and then 5 reported killing 6 to 25 and on up. And then we have two recipients in that time frame that reported killing in excess of 100 deer. I can tell you that's less than 150 deer. But I don't want to leave you with the impression that those statistics are necessarily going to reflect what happens in 2011, because we have a pretty extraordinary year. As I said, the reports are not due yet, but law enforcement it's just a matter of some fact gathering for this commission meeting, sent the game wardens in Uvalde County out to do a spot check, because our permittees have to keep a log of what's been taken up to that point, and they have to keep that on them. And so our game wardens went out in Uvalde County and checked the 6 permittees in Uvalde County. 3 of them reported not even utilizing the permit yet, hadn't killed a single animal. But the other 3 had reported killing a total of 301 deer. And in fact, really, one of them reported killing 150 and the other one 130. And so I think we can, with that, we can expect that our kill for 2011 probably will be as high as we've seen. We probably will still see quite a few that don't use a permit at all. But because of the drought, and particularly on irrigated crops, I would suspect that we're going to see our highest kills per permit out there for 2011. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Might I ask a question,
please,
Mr. Chair? I assume the permits aren't limited to deer season. It's whenever you see the animal, if you have a permit, you can take it.
That is correct. In fact, we do encourage folks to utilize deer hunters and deer seasons. But for our warm season crops, particularly cotton and some of the produce that's out there, the depredation is occurring during the summer months, and so that's when they really need those permits. We do issue some permits on winter wheat and oats across the state, but cotton almost comprises about 50% of our permit recipients. They're the ones that report growing cotton.
And are the permits issued to an individual who can then issue them to hunters? that they invite to their place, or are they specifically for the individual shooter?
The permit is issued to an individual, but they name shooters on the permit, and we have to get specific data. They have to turn that into us, and so there are named individuals, and only the named individuals that we have on record are allowed to shoot, and they also must keep a harvest log and then turn that into the applicant.
Clayton, what's, just to get a sense, and seeing it move around by county, what's working well with the program? What is not working as well in terms of, you know, original intent?
Well,
we alter.
Well, we talked about this a little yesterday. As far as at my level, at Mitch's level, Alan's level, we're not receiving the complaints that we were receiving prior to 2009, and we were spending quite a bit of time going out there. The way we administered that program was perceived to be pretty restrictive, and so that those complaints have really dwindled. Now, we are still getting complaints. Harmony Garcia is our person in the permit office that issues those permits, and she says she does still get complaints from farmers about carcass utilization. But as y'all may recall, you know, we had a person come to our annual public hearing and complain about their neighbor who they heard was killing 200 deer, and that was in Uvalde County. And so that's why we wanted to check Uvalde and just see if we had permittees that were killing quite a few deer. And so I suspect that now the pendulum will swing, and those folks that are adjacent to this farmland are the ones that are not going to be happy if they have a hunting operation, if they believe some of the more valuable animals are being killed. I suspect that that's where we'll start getting more complaints from. But as far as crop depredation, when we investigated this prior to 2009, we had some of the most restrictive program. Many other states are fairly liberal. And so we used it as a backdrop to know that we were at one end of the spectrum, and we moved that bar some. It was a big change for us. Folks are, like I said, this is a very unique year, but I don't doubt now that if we have hunting operations that are adjacent to some of these farmlands and there's not much forage out there on the rangeland, that some of our cooperators, our deer hunters, are going to see some significant changes in the deer population out there on adjacent property. So there's I would say there's going to be some repercussions that probably won't fare well for our hunting public.
It's helpful background. Appreciate it. Any other questions?
The permits allow the permit fees to hunt at night.
That's correct.
And do they still require them to notify the local warden when they're going to be acting?
Yes. There still is a notification requirement.
Are there any protocols for what happens to antlers?
The antlers have to be destroyed, so they have to be cut in two, and they also have to report to us or keep on the log the some dimensions on the antlers. To be honest with you, I can't remember if that's just points and spread or what that is, but you know, one thing we wanted to see is where there are trophy animals being taken, which are obviously the more valuable animals, and so those data are to be recorded on the log, but they are not to keep the antlers. The antlers are to be destroyed. At least to this point, and we've done some asking. Law enforcement has been monitoring the program very well, and we have had a few violations. One permittee that actually wasn't growing a commercial crop, and there was some lack of documentation on donation of the meat. But other than that, all the reports are, everybody else's paperwork is in order, so they're keeping accurate records as a whole.
One other quick one, Clayton. What would be some examples other than fencing of recommendations for recommendations for compliance or in the, obviously we don't do that now, right?
We can still do that. In fact, we had one, and this is there was a fear initially that I guess we might not monitor this as closely. When Harmony gets an application for a permit, the first thing she does is notify the biologist. And that permit is going to go out the door in 10 days unless our biologist says stop. We had at least one case where the biologist did go out on site and look, and most of the depredation appeared to be feral hogs. and the permittee was in the process of constructing a low net wire fence, and so we held up the permit. Our recommendation was finish the net wire fence. We want to see if you still have deer depredation out there, or if this is just hog depredation. And so we held it up until the fence was done, and there was still some deer depredation, so we issued the permit. But as far as other recommendations out there, you know, there's folks concocting up certain recipes to repel deer and noisemakers, but in short, you know, the deer get used to that, doesn't last very long. And even different mechanisms for electric fences have been tried with some degree of success, but probably more limited degree. So really the only fail-safe is to construct a fence. And you know, even when we looked up in Tom Green County and looked at some of the prices for cotton, in some cases when the depredation was so severe, it would, you know, the fence would pay for itself, you know, within 10 years easily. If the data that was being provided to us and the market sustained itself as it was at that time.
Clayton, do we spot check any of the permittees who are reporting zero kills? It seems sort of odd to me that you would be concerned enough that you go apply for a permit and have 35 people not report a single kill.
I won't be able to answer that one. Law enforcement may be able to add to that, but I do know that Scott Bach and David Sinclair sent out a request, and at least from the information I saw, it looks like our game wardens are monitoring these permits closely. When we did our pilot project in Tom Green County, a large number didn't report, and we had to follow up, and the reason they didn't report is they didn't kill anything. We believe strongly that folks think it's pretty easy to go out there and shoot deer on their field, and so they think that getting the permit is an easy solution, and it might be easy one night or two, but then it becomes a chore and a task, and in some cases those deer are not, you know, they're not out there when they drive out there. So I find it reasonable that folks think that's the solution, and then when they go attempt it, it doesn't work out that way.
Any other questions? Clayton?
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, Committee Item 3, Implementation of Legislation during the 82nd Texas Legislative Session, Senate Bill 498 regarding permits to trap, transport, transplant, and process TTP surplus white-tailed deer, request permission to publish rules in the Texas Register. Mr. Alan Kane.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, I'm Alan Kane, the white-tailed deer program leader. And this morning I'll be presenting a proposal to amend the trap, transport, and process regulations to define the conditions under which a qualified individual may be issued a TTP permit, or trap, transport, and process permit. Under current regulation, a TTP permit is available only to property owners associations or political subdivisions, and private landowners may not apply for a TTP permit unless they do so through a property owners association or a governmental subdivision such as a county commissioner's court or a county judge. Senate Bill 498 was enacted by the legislature this session, and that defines a qualified individual as an individual who has a wildlife management plan approved by the department. The bill also requires the commission to adopt regulations or rules to determine the circumstances under which the TTP permit may be issued to that qualified individual, or that they may obtain that TTP permit. So staff proposed the following rule that would allow a TTP permit to be issued to a qualified individual if that individual has been in reasonable compliance, as determined by the department, with the recommendations of the wildlife management plan for 2 years immediately preceding the TTP application, and that wildlife management plan must recommend a harvest of 100 deer in the year of the application for the TTP. The intent of these requirements is to encourage the use of traditional management methods including hunting, to lower deer populations before more drastic measures are taken to remove those, lower those deer populations. In addition, it would limit the applicability of this rule to landowners who do not have the option to apply for a TTP through their property owners association or political subdivision. So essentially these places where you've got a property owners association of a small acreage landowner and he perceives there to be a deer problem, you know, 2 or 3 acres, and he wants to remove those deer, this would limit his ability to do that as a qualified individual. Essentially staff wanted to leave these difficult questions concerning deer management within the property owners association in these small places up to those elected officials. In addition, the 100 deer minimum would also limit the applicability of this rule to those types of individuals. I'd also like to point out that during the 2011 or 10 and 11 season last year, the department issued 23 TTP permits. The average number of deer requested to be removed on those permits was 192 individuals, and that range from the range was from 12 to 505 individuals. And of the 23 permits, there was 18 that had a request to remove 100 deer or more, and only 5 less than that, and those range from 12 to 70 animals. So, and in summary, you know, this rule creates a mechanism for individual landowners to obtain a TTP permit, but only after they made a bona fide attempt to meet management recommendations of the Wildlife Management Plan that defines clear goals and a strategy to reach those goals. And so essentially we wanted folks to focus on their management plans and the goals of deer management rather than the tool that they use to get there. You know, a lot of times folks are coming after a permit and not necessarily looking at the bigger picture. And so that's part of what we were trying to accomplish there. In addition, we want to encourage the use of traditional hunting in times when hunter recruitment is an important issue. We want to make sure that we're encouraging that where we can. However, keep in mind that individuals that do not meet the requirements of this qualified individual may still apply for a TTP permit through the normal regulatory mechanisms that exist now. So they could still go get one, but it'd have to work through the property owner association or a county judge or another political subdivision in those situations. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions. Y'all have any?
Thanks, Alan. Any questions?
What do you mean by reasonable compliance versus, say, substantial compliance?
That's a good question. I think the intent when the Whitetail Deer Technical Committee met this summer was that we wanted folks not just to have a plan that they stick on the shelf and forget about. They needed to be working towards implementing some of the habitat management practices or attempting to meet harvest management recommendations. You know, if they're working with that biologist, they're going to be active in the sense that they're doing maybe some grazing management or they're implementing some of these practices, the biologist out there working with them. And in addition, to make sure that they're trying to meet harvest goals through traditional methods, through hunting versus, you know, just applying for this and trying to remove deer.
Your thought is that the bar ought to be reasonably low, fairly low, so if you're making a good faith effort to comply, that's sufficient rather than actually implementing the...
Well, I think there needs to be some... Well, it's a good point. There needs to be some implementation. It's not just something we don't want to have a plan and them not do anything, but we don't have a standard like they need to meet 50% of their management practices. We haven't defined that or don't want to. The individual biologist will have the discretion to, you know, determine if that's a reasonable attempt to meet management recommendations. However, there will obviously be oversight by the big game program, myself or Clayton, in situations where there is a concern that either we're being too lenient or too harsh, maybe in those situations.
Okay. That's what they recommend, yeah. I mean, it seems to me if you want to ensure that there's a more follow-through as opposed to effort, you'd use the word substantial. But if you you and the committee believe it ought to be more flexible and I think reasonable is a better choice of word, a better word.
Yeah, the flexibility is important, I think, because each individual landowner is obviously different in what they can accomplish, you know, with their means and what their habitat, you know, what exists out there and what can be done. So I think the flexibility is important. But that's a good point. I appreciate that very much.
I think it is a good point. I think, you know, if we could just, staff could take a look at, you know, how we comply or how the permittees comply and how, when they don't comply, why, what are the reasons for it? You know, it'd be good to have a little bit of detail on that to better understand the motivations, you know, whether they're, could be anything, could be weather, drought, obviously all the things we're dealing with this year in particular, but just to get a sense that it's being done, conducted in the proper spirit of the permit system.
We can do that. Thanks.
But let me ask, are these permits being issued for mule deer also, or just whitetail? I don't know whitetail we're talking about here.
I believe it's just whitetail.
Yeah.
It's just whitetail.
Okay. Thank you.
But there was discussion about, I mean, haven't we talked about doing that? From expanding the mule deer?
I don't know.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. I was thinking of the crop depredation.
The depredation.
Forget it.
Yes, sir.
Chairman, I just want to make sure we understand kind of this direction with respect to kind of the reasonable effort. Are you comfortable with us just kind of monitoring that as we go forward and then kind of coming back to y'all and let you know what our biologists are seeing? Is they're applying kind of reasonable discretion in the field? And if we feel like at some point we need to come back with some recommendations to tighten that up and further define it, would that be an appropriate course? Just
Yes. I mean, I'm comfortable, staff's comfortable, and we're actually looking at it and assessing the reasons for compliance or lack of compliance, but I don't think we need to necessarily come back to the commission unless we
see something.
Unless we see something that's you know, not in keeping with the intent of it.
Okay.
Can I ask this just a couple of threshold questions? I assume that when you get permission to do this program, you have to have a place to put the wildlife. You have permission to trap, but then I assume
these deer will be processed. So once they're caught on a ranch,
okay,
They'll be killed, and then the meat is donated to a charitable organization.
Okay, so it's not a moving.
No, they're not
central location or
processing facility.
Got it. Okay, that's different. All right.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Alan. Any other questions?
Do we need to, just point of clarification, do I need to request to publish this in the Texas Register?
Yes.
Okay.
I was just there. If there's no further discussion, I'll authorize staff to publish or propose changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment.
Period.
Thank you. Item 4, threatened and endangered non-game species, delisting of the brown pelican and cleanup of the threatened species list. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Wendy Collins.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Wendy Connolly. I'm the Rare Species Program Lead in the Wildlife Division. Staff requests your permission to publish proposed amendments to the Department's list of state threatened and federally endangered non-game wildlife found in Texas Administrative Code Section 65.175 and 65.176, respectively. My presentation today outlines the few proposed amendments to both the threatened and endangered species lists. Currently on the threatened species list, we have the scarlet snake. We would like to clarify that as the only two subspecies of scarlet snake which occur in Texas, so we're adding the subspecies epithet to those to that name. Also, on the threatened species list, we already have the northern cat-eyed snake. We would like to clarify that only one subspecies occurs in Texas, so we would like to add the subspecies epithet to that list. On the endangered species list, we would like to add two aquatic animals, the Comal Springs riffle beetle and the Comal Springs dryopid beetle. These are already on the federal list of species. We would also like to update nomenclature for two endangered species, the Houston toad and the golden cheek warbler, based on recent scientific research into their taxonomy. And lastly, we would like to also showcase a little bit of recovery success story and promote its removal from the federal endangered species list and the state compatible list. In the nearly 40 years between federal listing and delisting, brown pelican breeding in Texas went from nearly zero to over 6,000 breeding pairs, which represents about half of the detected breeding pairs throughout its entire Atlantic and Gulf Coast ranges. The brown pelican delisting is the result of the restoration and protection work of many hardworking people and groups. One project which continues to contribute significantly to the long-term stability of the brown pelican population in Texas is the North Deer Island Salt Marsh and Rookery Island in Galveston Bay. TPWD accepted the Presidential Coastal America Partnership Award in 2009 on behalf of a large coalition of public and private partners who contributed to that particular project. That is it. I will entertain any questions, please.
Thanks, questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
Okay, I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 5, nuisance alligator control rules, request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mitch.
Good morning, Mitch. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the Big Game Program Director. And believe it or not, my presentation this morning has nothing to do with deer or deer permits. Instead, this morning I'll present some proposed changes to the way in which we handle nuisance alligator complaints. Much like the brown pelican success story that Ms. Connolly referenced in her presentation, the once endangered American alligator is doing very, very well in Texas today. Too well by some folks' standards. In 2007, we estimated approximately 150,000 alligators just within a three-county area of prime habitat in the Upper Coast. Hurricane Ike did have a big impact, a negative impact on nesting activity in this area, but anecdotal information indicates that the population had not been adversely impacted. In fact, the number of nuisance alligator complaints that we've received from the mid and upper coast has not declined any in the past 5 years. And as y'all know, this area is an urban, industrial area. To say the least, it's an area that has a lot of people, a lot of alligators, and it's a perfect recipe for wildlife-human interactions or conflicts. The department fielded approximately 1,100 complaints in each of the last few years. And under our current procedures, the cost associated with 1,100 complaints is in the neighborhood of $121,000 of staff time. That's just salary. That doesn't include operating expenses such as fuel cost, equipment cost, or administrative cost. When we get a call, we first must determine whether or not it is indeed a nuisance alligator situation. This typically requires a site visit, which consumes about 4 hours of staff time. If it is determined to be a nuisance alligator situation, then we contact a nuisance control hunter who contracts directly with the department. They pay the department a per foot price for each alligator taken. But there are only 28 people in the state who are willing to conduct nuisance alligator control activities. Quite frankly, there's very little, if any, incentive for them to do so. The alligator market has not been good in the last several years, and this fee that they pay the department and this contract fee is cuts into their profits. I mean, quite frankly, if the alligator is not large enough or if it's too far away, then they're not likely to respond. And in that case, the department ends up removing the alligator, which eats up a lot of time and resources. All alligator removals are authorized on a case-by-case basis by the department, and we simply cannot afford to continue operating this inefficient and costly process. The proposed rule would implement a market-driven approach that would allow control hunters to contract directly with the landowners where this nuisance alligator problem occurs. We hope that this would incentivize more people to become nuisance control hunters, and because this proposed process would still allow them to process or sell the alligators as they're currently allowed to do. So if they contract directly with the landowners, they could cover their overhead costs, their cost of going out on site, making that site visit, capturing the alligator, and then actually make a profit when they sell the alligator. The department would still respond in all emergency situations. Since department staff would not be directly involved in a case-by-case basis, we do believe that it would be important to ensure that all nuisance control hunters are adequately trained. They're qualified to do this. We need to make sure that they're qualified to determine whether or not the alligator is indeed a nuisance alligator. We'd like to be sure that they minimize all threats to human safety and that all nuisance alligators are treated humanely. For this reason, the proposed rule would require prospective permittees to complete a department-administered course in the proper methods of alligator control and to pass a test to assess that knowledge before a permit could be issued. So under this proposal, the department could refuse permit issuance if, in the department's determination, the individual lacks the skill, the experience, or the aptitude to adequately perform these nuisance alligator control activities. The proposal limits the take to bona fide nuisance alligators, which is defined as an alligator that is depredating or a threat to human health or safety. The proposal does not modify the current tagging requirements. By federal law, alligators cannot be exported from any state that is not approved for export from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And to be approved for export, the state must require that all harvested alligators are tagged with a CITES tag, which is an identification marker that allows lawfully taken crocodilian species to be differentiated from protected look-alike species. The proposed rule would prescribe the reporting, notification, and record-keeping requirements for nuisance control hunters. It would prohibit nuisance control activities without the written authorization of the landowner. The rule would also require each control hunter to maintain a daily log of all nuisance control activities, which would include the case number of the nuisance alligator complaint. So every one of these calls would still have to come through one of our law enforcement offices, and the dispatcher would have to issue a case number in every one of these cases. So if they go directly to the nuisance control hunter first, then that person would advise them to contact the department and get this case number. So we will be able to trace all of these, any complaint. So this log would include the case number, the date and the location of each nuisance alligator captured, the sex and the length of each alligator captured, and the disposition of each alligator captured. The rule would also require control hunters to retain an invoice or a receipt for each alligator that's taken that is eventually sold or otherwise transferred to another individual. And the rule would continue to require control hunters to complete an alligator hide tag report immediately upon the take of a nuisance alligator and to submit it to the department within 7 days of take. That's the current requirement that we have and we would continue with. And we would also continue to require the quarterly reports, that they submit quarterly reports of all nuisance control activity. As has been established with other permitting programs, we propose that the decision to issue a permit should take into account an applicant's history of convictions involving the capture and possession of live animals and major violations of Parks and Wildlife Code, your Class B and Class A misdemeanors and felonies. The denial of such a permit would not be automatic. It would be within the discretion of the department. Factors that may be considered by the department in determining whether or not to refuse permit issuance would include the seriousness of the offense, the number of offenses, the existence or absences of a pattern of offenses, the length of time between the offense and the permit application, the applicant's efforts towards rehabilitation and the accuracy of information provided by the applicant regarding the applicant's prior permit history. The proposal also provides a mechanism for persons who have been denied a permit, who have been denied permit issuance, to have the opportunity to have such decisions reviewed by department managers. The proposed new subsection is intended to help ensure that decisions affecting permit denial are well-founded. This is an established process that has been in effect for various deer permit programs for the last few years. This review panel would consist of the following individuals or their designees: the Deputy Executive Director for Natural Resources, the Director of the Wildlife Division, and the Deputy Division Director of the Wildlife Division. A request for this review must be submitted within 10 days of notice of the notice of the denial, and then the review must be scheduled within 10 days of the department receiving that request. And finally, we propose an annual permit fee of $252, which is identical to the current fee for an alligator farmer's permit. We currently, as I mentioned a while ago, we currently have 28 people in this state who are willing and who are authorized to conduct these nuisance alligator control activities. We do expect this number to increase with this proposal because we think it does provide some additional incentive for people to engage in this activity. But currently, with those 28 individuals, our annual revenue is approximately $9,800. If we were to continue, if we were to move forward with this new process and continue to have only 28 nuisance control hunters, then our annual revenue would only be around $7,000. But we would no longer have $121,000 of staff time dedicated to this activity. But again, we do expect there to be a large growth in this program because of this market-driven, market-based approach. And so we anticipate additional revenue as well. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
As you may have said it, but the conditions for permit denial and also the conditions for the review process are similar to other permits that we have, is that right?
Yes, sir. They're similar to some of our deer permits. Our deer breeder permit program, our DNP, triple T, TTP, and I'm probably leaving some out, but we follow this same process. And again, one thing I did try to emphasize is something that we've emphasized over the last few years with respect to our deer permitting programs. A conviction, even a conviction to, say, Chapter 43, Subchapter CELRR, does not automatically result in subsequent permit denial. It still does depend on a number of those factors I mentioned, such as the egregiousness of the violation and the number of offenses, et cetera.
Thanks.
Any other questions? You propose that there be no fee for the control tag, right?
Sorry, for the tag?
For the tag, yeah, under N on page 46 of the book, anyway. But you do have a fee on all the other tags.
I think that's a little misleading the way it's written, in that I think it implies that we currently charge for a fee for these tags for nuisance control alligators, and we do not. But you're right, we do have a fee for other alligators that are harvested, alligators that are harvested by hunters. Alligator farmers do have to pay a fee for their tags, but our current process does not require a fee for nuisance control alligators for those gators to be tagged, and as you noted, we propose not to add a fee at this time. And Commissioner, the main reason we did spend a good bit of time talking about that and trying not to come with a process that's going to result in a loss of revenue, it's very important to us that we try and incentivize more people to get involved in this activity so that we can truly depend on the private sector to help us with these problems. So again, just to reiterate, you're right that we're not proposing we're proposing that there is no fee for those tags, but that's not a change from our current process.
If this program expands the way you hope it will, and we come back and look at this again as a tagging, the fact there is no fee for the tag?
Absolutely. I think, for one, we want to monitor and make sure that we are recovering our costs associated with administering this program. And so that's something we're going to want to keep a close eye on as we move forward with anyway. We're also going to want to keep a close eye on these reports, these logs that they're required to keep in these reports, monitor the take, and make sure that we're not leading, you know, don't end up with any resource concerns either. And so we want to look at all aspects of this closely as we move forward, including whether or not we need to eventually charge a fee, and if this $252 annual permit fee is adequate as well.
Is the tag, is it a CITES tag for everything? I mean, for farmers, for, you know, depredation, for, is it all the same tag?
Yes, ma'am. Again, for Texas to be qualified to be approved to export alligators, then any alligator harvested in the state has to have a CITES tag.
Obviously, this is, Bart, about departmental efficiency with no measurable impact on the resource, negative impact on the resource, and so principles.
There's plenty of them. I've got to get some. We've got a bunch of property in that little red circle down there on the Nature's River, and we kill so well. My nephew's got one over 13 feet. Last year, I mean, and so, and there's houses that back right up to it. So, I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about that, you know, they get up in the yard. So, Ralph and I were briefly talking. What makes a lot of sense to me is to get the thing going and try to get more people involved, you know, so we just basically save the money in the department. That's the way I see it.
Swim in the pool.
Yeah.
If you think about it,
go a lot faster.
It's not a lot different, in my opinion, than the direction we went with white-tailed deer back around 1990, and the department decided to get out of that trapping business and turn it to the private sector.
Thanks, Ben. Any other questions? I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the requirement of comment period.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Item 6, 2012-2013 Statewide Hunting Proclamation Preview. I guess we're starting with Alan Kane and Robert Press.
All right, there we go. For the record, again, I'm Alan Kane, Whitetail Deer Program Leader, and today I'll be presenting several potential changes regarding whitetail deer hunting regulations. And obviously Robert Perez, my co-presenter, will be addressing some potential potential changes regarding game bird regulations. Last year, the department received a petition for rulemaking from State Representative Jody Lobenberg requesting archery-only deer season in Collin and Rockwall counties. And in the process of formulating staff recommendations to the petition for rulemaking request, staff determined that hunting opportunity could be provided in these two counties. In addition, Dallas County could be potentially considered in there, which adjoins Rockwall County. Currently, the Wildlife Division staff monitors deer populations at a resource management unit scale, determine impacts of the harvest regulations on those deer populations. However, in urban and suburban areas that are characterized by highly fragmented habitats containing isolated and very variable deer populations, such as Collin, Rockwall, and Dallas County, monitoring efforts in those areas are essentially meaningless. They just wouldn't provide any valuable data. In addition, populations in closed counties, which would include Collin, Rockwall, and Dallas right now, are not monitored either. The season's been closed in Collin, Rockwall, and Dallas for approximately 25 years or maybe a little longer, presumably on the assumption that there lacks a sustainable deer population in those areas because there's a lack of native habitat available to support those deer populations, obviously. In a situation, in these areas, or staff do realize that there is some small pockets of habitat in these counties, obviously with a few deer. And for example, the photo that you see on the slide there or on your screen, that's a buck that an individual from Collin County sent in, and just giving us an example of the type of deer that are available in some of these small pockets up there. And so they wanted those opportunities to potentially hunt those animals. The situation in these counties is similar to nearby Grayson County, where the majority of that county wouldn't support deer populations except in the narrow band along the Red River and Lake Texoma and the Hagerman National Wildlife Refuge up there. Grayson County has had an open season, restricted archer only since the early 60s. And in analyzing Representative Lobenberg's petition for rulemaking, staff determined there was no biological reason not to allow hunting in Collin and Rockwall County, however small that hunting opportunity may be, but there was a chance to allow for that. In addition, it would provide an additional method for addressing nuisance deer issues where the use of archer equipment wasn't prohibited by county or municipal ordinances out there. So maybe as a tool to address some of these urban deer issues that may arise in there. In addition, staff also determined that Dallas County, obviously next to it, was suitable for a deer season in this urban hunting unit type approach, you know, where it's not a resource management unit where we monitor the population, more of this urban hunting unit style approach. And for simplicity's sakes and avoidance of law enforcement issues resulting from potential different regulations that we could put in those counties, staff proposed that the Grayson County season structure should be employed in all four of these counties that currently exist in Grayson County. Staff also note that traditional biological rationales that we use to monitor deer populations to justify season lengths and bag limits are moot in the case of these particular counties, given that the continued urbanization of these counties and the sparse deer habitat that exists will likely decline in the future and be impacted by urbanization. So staff suggests these potential changes, which is to implement the season structure in Collin, Rockwall, and Dallas County that currently exists in Grayson County, which would include a special and general archery season with a four deer bag limit to include two bucks and two antlerless deer. And antler restrictions would apply for bucks. In addition, staff recommend removing the permit requirements for harvest antlers deer in Grayson County, and then that would not be required in Collin, Rockwall, or Dallas counties either. Again, the chosen season structure is to provide uniformity in the regulations and ease of enforcement, not necessarily biological management of the resource in these particular counties. Galveston County is another closed county that has a closed season but contains fragmented habitats that support deer populations. And currently all counties surrounding Galveston County, including Harris, which is Houston, have an open general deer season. These counties are similar in characteristics to Galveston in that they have are characterized by fragmented habitats and small but huntable deer populations are located throughout those areas, you know, Fort Bend, Harris, Brazoria County. Staff determined that like NAF, North Texas counties, there's no biological reason not to allow for a deer season in Galveston County, and it can be provided under the current regulatory structure of the surrounding counties that are there. Galveston County fits within Resource Management Unit 12, which is a unit that we do monitor the deer population in. Staff do not see a biological reason to prohibit hunting in this area, and the regulation is not expected to have a negative impact on the resource, but should provide additional hunter opportunity where available in these areas, and also give folks a chance to manage their deer populations in these small but isolated pockets of habitat. The additional hunting opportunity would consist of an archery-only season, a general deer season, and a special late muzzleloader season. The bag limit would be four deer, two bucks, antler restrictions, and then two antlers deer, and a permit would be required after Thanksgiving on, and essentially so they would have it up front, they would have a 23 or 27 day doe season up there where a permit would not be required, but it would be a, that's what staff would, potential changes we're looking at. Before we get to questions, a couple of points. You'll probably notice in your agenda that there was an item under the non-substantive and housekeeping changes referring to clarification of Lamps counties. And staff looked at that a little bit closer. We determined there was changes for that particular clarification were unnecessary, and so there's no discussion on that item. And then in addition, I wanted to give you a quick update in response to requests from the commission. We are conducting a survey of West Texas landowners and hunters to gauge their interest in the extension of the mule deer MLD season in that country out there. We mailed opinion surveys to mule deer MLD cooperators, non-mule deer MLD landowners in those areas, mule deer MLD agents, and mule deer hunters in those areas. And they just went out, I think, October 21st or somewhere around there. We're expecting the results back in about 2 months, and we'll be able to present those results to the commission hopefully at that time after we've had a chance to analyze that information. And if you have any questions about the deer proposal, I'll be happy to try to answer those.
Quick clarification. So Grayson County currently is not full season either sex, but it would be in addition to the other three counties.
It has an archery season and a general season.
Yes.
And it's restricted, obviously, to archery equipment only. And the thing we're changing in Grayson County is removing it's to harvest the antlers deer, you have to have MLD permits, and we're taking that requirement out. Like Colin Rockwell in Dallas, it's just there's so few deer, and they're limited just to certain pockets there. It's not a resource concern, and we want to be consistent with the regulation for law enforcement issues.
Good. Thanks.
When we had, two or three years ago, when there was a push to open up grazing season to rifle, we had those meetings up there. It was a very vocal group of landowners and hunters. And my question is there any reason to run this proposed change by any of those folks, or have you done so?
We haven't run it by the public up there. The law enforcement, our biologists are aware, they all were okay with these proposals. There was some concern by staff. There might be a little hesitancy by the folks up there in Grayson County removing the requirement for MLD permit, but it's to be consistent with the regulation, and we're not sure that there's a resource concern in those areas up there. But I mean, I would expect as we go forward that through public comment and public hearings that we get feedback from the public and can adjust.
Well, I just would encourage maybe some communication with them so they don't hear about it through the
section.
That's a good point.
They are vocal.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we'll be especially sensitive about that. Absolutely. There's some good points of contact up there in Grayson County in terms of kind of who are the influence leaders there that we can certainly reach out to and start to have some substantive discussions on this, make sure they understand what the proposal is, and bring that feedback back to you in January.
Prior to the proposal, informally,
oh, sure.
Prior to the proposal on the Texas Register.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still just being in the scoping phase, so absolutely.
Good idea. Good. Any other questions? Brown, please.
I guess, Chairman, before we leave deer, just a couple of things I'd like to bring up. And Alan's mention of the survey that we're doing on the MLDP mule deer permit holders and kind of attitudes about seasons and so forth. Probably an opportune time just to mention that internally, you know, we have started some discussions about the MLDP program as a whole. I want to make sure the commission knows that this program has grown, I think, beyond our wildest dreams. Very, very successful. At the same time, you know, I will confess that we've got a little permit fatigue, and we've also seen, in some cases, a departure from how this started, you know, with working with landowners on how we manage habitat and accomplish landowners' goals with respect to their deer management and wildlife management, and the MLDP was an important tool to help accomplish that. what a lot of our biologists are seeing now are people coming and just wanting immediately to start talking about the permit and how many deer permits can they get, when am I going to get it, how quickly can I get them, why can't I get them. And I think it's probably a good time that we step back with the volume of interest here and take a close look at that and work with our biologists and stakeholders, have a discussion with the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee to give us some kind of counsel and input on that program, and look if some improvements and refinements that should be made. Because again, ultimately we want our substantive conversations with private landowners to be about wildlife habitat and helping them realize their goals. And we've got a lot of permit related tools to help landowners. But rather than having the conversations always start at this permit or that permit, let's figure out a way to maybe we start back at some of the basics. So I just wanted to kind of forecast those discussions that are coming in, that our desire, Mr. Bass, to kind of talk to the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee and get some counsel and strategic direction on that.
Carter, if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm not, but the number of biologists that we have in the field and available to go visit with private landowners today is the same number we had in the field before the MLD permit was ever instituted. So we've gone from zero MLD acres and associated tasks for the biologists to 27 million acres, and I don't know how many permittees that is.
It's about 7,400 or somewhere.
Yeah.
And we still have the same number of biologists in the field, I believe.
Yeah.
Which is...
There's probably, if you look at the district biologists that handle the bulk of that, it's probably 85 or 90. And then you have folks in the WMAs that do assist a little bit.
So the workload on that group of biologists is exponentially expanded, therefore their ability to engage each landowner in meaningful discussion of what are your goals, what do you want to do, here's how we can help you, here's what, you know, I'd recommend. The ability for those biologists to be hands-on is, they're spread pretty thin.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, that's obviously a, some kind of a weak link in this whole thing at this point.
Yeah.
What you do about it is another question.
Yeah.
But that's a good point of consideration for this review, I think. That's a
very good point.
I think, Mr. Bass, if y'all are supportive of that, we'd like to do that. I think you nailed it, Mr. Bass. And I think, you know, it becomes a question is what's the highest and best use of our biologist time? And where it's evolved into more of issuing permits, you know, one, again, I'm not sure we're having the depth of conversations we could have to work with landowners who are really committed to improving habitat on their property. Also, to be fair, it becomes a job satisfaction issue for our biologists. And I want to make sure that we're mindful and cognizant of that as we think about it. And so,
if there's ways we can restructure systems so that they spend less time at their computer doing paperwork, whether it be digital or physical, and more time in their truck and with the landowners, you know,
that's success.
Better job satisfaction, better customer delivery. And there may be some ways
that type of thing. Good.
When you look at the growth in MLDs, I mean, you look at a WMP application as kind of a leading indicator of what's in the pipeline for potentially future MLDPs, correct?
Yes.
And how is that trending as an indication of what we can expect in terms of growth over the next couple of years?
If you look at just the trend, it's a steady growth rate. And I don't, you know, percentage, it's probably growing 5 or 10% a year. I don't know.
It's doing that.
But it's doing that.
Okay.
You know, we
so
shared that, that with the Whitetail Deer
Advisory
Committee.
The program.
Yeah.
And the interest in the program. So.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and I you know, we have to at some level be mindful of the integrity of the program, that, you know, these programs are based on, you know, habitat issues, and if we're not able to deliver the expertise of the landowner and also some kind of audit function that, you know, yes, things are really happening, there is compliance, then at some point, you know, I think we need to be worried that the integrity of the program gets undermined. It takes a lot of time to do a bite count survey,
yeah,
you know, that kind of thing. And it's valuable information, but you know, we have the same
number of biologists
done it and a lot more acres to cover. So
it's timely.
It has been.
Yeah, it has. I think we just want to bring this to the fore and really think through it thoughtfully. I mean, I guess, Alan, the statistics I'm aware of is 8 years ago we had 7 or 8 million acres under wildlife management plans, and today we have almost 27 million acres of land, and just a steadily escalating demand, you know, for a variety of services. And as Alan said, I don't see that changing. You know, the individuals that are buying land today are largely attracted to the land because of their interest in recreation and wildlife. And our biologists provide, I think, an extraordinary service and counsel to landowners who want to seek that out. But we certainly well exceeded the capacity component now, and look forward to kind of working on this.
It's 1 out of every 6 acres in Texas. That's
pretty extraordinary. Yeah. Yeah. Any other thing on that, Chairman? Any other direction?
That's exactly right. And I think those are good points. I think landowners are increasingly understanding of and educated with regard to the importance of habitat and the connection that habitat management has as a backbone to wildlife and other recreational resources. So I agree. I think it's a growth is a great thing, but it also sometimes poses some challenges. I think it is timely. I agree with that.
Good. Chairman, if I could, just one other issue real quickly. I don't have a lot of detail on this, but Commissioner Martin, who was hoping to be here, you know, had asked me about, you know, what's the legality of using suppressors as a legal means to hunt white-tailed deer. Obviously, our rules do not allow that now. You can use a suppressor to hunt feral hogs and coyotes. You know, there are some states that allow that, Alaska and Kansas, Mississippi come to mind, you know, states that have had an interest in that with respect to being able to use a rifle to hunt in kind of near urban areas just to help, you know, muffle the sound and for hearing protection and so forth. And so she did ask if we would look into that and get some more information for the commission, and I want to let you know that we'll explore that. So just wanted to make sure you're aware of that.
Thank you.
Questions for Alan? Robert.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I am, in fact, Robert Pettis. I am the Upland Game Bird Program Leader, and I'll be presenting the Game Bird portion of the Wildlife Regulations Preview. The first potential change is in regard to pheasant, which would be the elimination of pheasant season in 3 coastal counties in response to an absence of population. Those counties in yellow are Chambers, Jefferson, and Liberty. These are the only coastal counties with a current pheasant season. Back in 2003, the commission adopted closure of the pheasant season in Wharton, Fort Bend, Brazoria, and Matagorda counties for the same reason, absence of population shown there in black. These populations were the result of over 17,000 pheasants stocked by the department in the 1970s and 80s. Populations have gradually blinked out over time as these birds are not well adapted to the climate and available habitat present day. This potential change would effectively close the pheasant season on the Texas coast. Next is a recommendation regarding lesser prairie chicken. In 2005, the commission adopted rules to create a managed lands permit approach for the harvest of lesser prairie chicken, which allowed for the harvest only on lands with approved wildlife management plans. prior to this time, Lesser Prairie Chicken had a two-day season, general season, with a special permit. These 2005 rules were adopted in response to long-term data in declining populations for Lesser Prairie Chicken. Then, in 2009, the commission suspended the season, which effectively closed any opportunity for Lesser Prairie Chicken harvest in Texas. And since that time, populations have continued to decline. It now appears that the resumption of prairie chicken hunting will not take place in the foreseeable future. Because there is no longer need for the rules, staff recommends the repeal of the language which sets forth the requirements for the harvest of lesser prairie chicken on managed lands. The final item for preview is in regard to quail. The potential change would be the reconfiguration of the current quail season structure. Over the next few months, the Wildlife Division's Upland Game Bird staff and technical committee will review season length, bag limits, and the possibility of regional differences or zones for the Texas quail season, and determine if modifications to the 2012-2013 season are warranted. Current drought conditions across Texas have had significant impacts on wildlife habitat. These conditions, coupled with the long-term decline in quail and predictions that the drought could continue through the spring breeding period, may necessitate changes to the existing season structure for quail. Staff recommendations will be submitted for review by the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee, and formal recommendations will be presented to the Commission in January. According to the National Breeding Bird Survey, bobwhite quail have significantly declined in Texas. Over the past four decades, they've declined at a rate of about 2.8% per year. There are, however, major differences in trends among Texas ecological regions. The Rolling Plains, for instance, had the lowest count on record this year, while the Gulf Coast observed quail numbers well above average in suitable habitat. Other regions, like the Piney Woods, have not had huntable numbers of bobwhites for the most part in decades. Harvest has declined along with populations. Quail hunters also mirror this trend. There's been a decline of over 75% in harvest and hunters since the mid-1980s. Quail face many challenges for their survival, but these are the big ones. The lack of fire and proper grazing, exotic grasses, habitat loss and fragmentation, and more recently, long-term drought. Harvest regulations alone will not reverse quail declines, but under the current climatic conditions, they will likely help some birds make it through tough years that may not have otherwise. In addition to potential regulatory changes, the department will continue its conservation efforts and expand its programs for quail and grassland birds. Here are a few of our current activities as outlined in the Upland Game Bird Strategic Plan. On the ground, field staff directly interact with landowners and managers to restore and conserve native habitats, and our wildlife management area staff work diligently to create and maintain habitat on state lands. Manpower, a newly created conservation delivery specialist position with the Oaks and Prairie Joint Venture, which when filled will target building cooperatives and partnerships to help native grasslands and savannas in this key area of the state. Incentives, like our Pastures for Upland Bait, Upland Birds program, help landowners kill out exotic species like Bermuda and replace them with native grasses. Educational opportunities. This includes ongoing intensive game bird management workshops directed for field staff and, of course, landowner field days. We also have a newly created quail webpage with plenty of great information and links. Partnerships. We are working at the national, state, and regional level with a variety of partners. We also continue to work with the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee and the relatively new group, the Quail Roundtable. Quail Roundtable was established in the spring of 2010. Commissioner Duggins and landowner Randy Rogers played a key role in the inception of the Roundtable, whose primary purpose is to act as a clearinghouse of information where ideas can be exchanged and activities coordinated among the many quail interests in Texas, and also to avoid duplication of efforts. The department plays a lead role in this group, which has met four times to date. Membership includes resource agencies like NRCS, Texas AgriLife, research institutions like Caesar Clayburgh and Texas Tech, conservation landowner organizations, and ranchers and quail enthusiasts. This concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I can take those at this time.
Just out of curiosity, on your first deal on the Chambers, Jefferson, and like those counties, you know, on the pheasant deal, how does that work on people that I know there's one, I don't know how many others, where they actually you know, they buy the bird. It's not a native wild pheasant like we're used to, you know, up in Panhandle. How does any of that apply? I mean, if there's people still buying and selling those kind of hunts and the birds get loose, which they will, you know, what is law enforcement supposed to do at that point? Or is there anything that they do?
There is a private bird hunting area license, and underneath that license, all birds are banded, whether it be pheasant or quail, and in any county, that activity can be conducted year-round. And so that's a permit process where you can apply and get one of these. Your boundary would be marked according to that permit, and you could harvest those birds still in those counties. Outside of that, it's my understanding that the season will be closed at that species.
I think the issue, Commissioner, it's a great point, because what we don't want to do is inadvertently penalize somebody. There hadn't been wild pheasants in years on the coast, and it does become a little bit of a credibility issue for us having a pheasant season in counties with no pheasants. And so folks that want to come out and I think we're just trying to kind of remedy that, you know, a novice hunter that lives over there and sees that they can hunt pheasants in Chambers County, and then they go to look for opportunities to do that, and you know, then we say, well, there are no pheasants, and well, why do you have a pheasant season? So I think we're hoping that the private bird hunting area license can help, you know, resolve issues, where you have folks lawfully handling that. And so that's the intent, to still allow that.
What's your point? What happens to one that wander off the barn property?
Well, what I heard is you can't shoot him legally, so.
Whereas currently you can't with temperatures.
Correct.
Is there a way to declare him an exotic in that county to where he wouldn't can't shoot him?
Good question. That's a very good question, Mr. Bass. I'm not sure about a thing about a precedent. Well, let us look into that. Yeah.
My neighbor keeps releasing a name that's in the barnyard and I hate the damn thing.
Like guineas, you know.
I see your point.
I have a question for Robert. As far as the bag limit on quail, have we observed, or do you observe, that landowners tend to kind of set the bag limit based on the availability of the number of birds that are out there?
Right.
State bag limit, really, 15, I think it's 15 right now, is that correct?
Correct.
Is there a need to lower it, or just do landowners kind of comply with the number of birds they have? If they have birds, they hunt. If they don't have birds, they don't hunt as many, or?
I think quail hunters as a group are very good at self-regulating, and that amount of, or the degree which they self-regulate varies across the state. For instance, some areas like South Texas, we see a high degree of self-regulation. In 4 years, we see fewer hunts, areas closed to hunting, reduced bags, or limited number of hours. Only one covey rise, or shooting birds only from the covey rise and not chasing singles. We see a lot of cases where landowners and even lease operations are self-limiting far beyond the state fixed liberal regulations. Yes.
Are there areas that are the other end of the spectrum of that?
I believe so. I believe there are other areas of the state where, especially if someone's paying for a lease out of state, coming from someplace, and they want to get the maximum benefit of that property, we see that in other regions of the state where maybe we'll see an area that receives over-harvest at that scale.
Less active, less lease.
Correct.
Taylor. Questions or discussion for Robert?
If this trend doesn't reverse, this doesn't look particularly good for quail hunters in Texas, does it?
It doesn't look good for quail. There have been major droughts in the past of the 50s. There have been major catastrophic fires in the Panhandle in the 1960s. And it's amazing how resilient and how quick this species does recover in areas of suitable habitat. I think the greater concern is we have fewer and fewer areas of suitable habitat. That's the big issue.
I think Robert hit that well in terms of our concern of what's happening on the ground, but also you look range-wide at what's happening with quail. I mean, the declines are precipitous, and they're very, very sobering. And this is, you know, unquestionably one of our most prized, if not the most prized, game bird in the state. And, you know, we just want to make sure that we're having substantive discussions with the commission about, you know, engaging in this and making sure that we're playing a leadership role here and helping to arrest this and address it, make sure hunters and landowners are absolutely as informed as possible about what they can do to help us address kind of this quail conservation issue. And this drought has really, really exacerbated things. And if ever there was a sense of urgency and a time to act in a variety of ways, you know, now's the time. And so we wanted to have this preliminary conversation with y'all and look forward to coming back in January with more feedback and more concepts to explore.
Great. I think it's
comment, and I think Reed probably knows Andy Lane down in Houston. He's head of that big quail one that they've resurfaced it. But my comment would be, we know a few people, and I know there's a lot of others, but this quail deal is such a huge issue that when we come up with some ideas, we might ought to send out some invitations and get some communication going with people that are really serious about managing the asset. Because as you say, you know, South Georgia, I mean, people I know are very serious about not overhunting, about any of that. And so if we get some of them in the loop, perhaps that would be a...
Absolutely.
Get their input anyway.
Yeah, and I Commissioner, it's a great point. I mean, there's so many very serious quail enthusiasts who are very concerned about this. And obviously, as Robert said, we've got some regional differences around the state, and we want to start trying to acknowledge those as we think about this issue. But, you know, where there are individuals that y'all think would be prudent for us to kind of reach out to and make sure we're getting input on that, please do let us know. Yeah, absolutely.
I agree, and I think it would be very helpful for the commission to have a better understanding of regional differences, population dynamics, other factors that contribute to, you know, these overall aggregate declines that we see, so that we can manage it on a regional basis, perhaps. But I would look forward to receiving more information about that.
Thank you.
Both. All right. Item 7 is the 2012 and 13 statewide recreational commercial fishing proclamation preview. Starting out with Ken.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski with the Inland Fisheries Division. And I'm here today to go over some of our potential changes to our freshwater fishing regulations. We have these in three broad categories. First, we're modifying some existing regulations on four reservoirs, Aquila, Fort Phantom Hill, Proctor for largemouth bass, and on Possum Kingdom Reservoir for striped bass. Our staff is constantly looking at what regulations we have on our water bodies, and when we determine that those regulations can be changed to improve the fishing or simplify the regulations, we're always looking at that. Also, we typically implement some regulations on newly opened waters to ensure that we have quality fishing after those waters are open. And finally, we have some gear restrictions on that one new water body, Nacogneach, and also on some of our state parks. Starting out at Lake Aquila, which is a reservoir that was impounded in 1982 by the Army Corps. Over time, the habitat has deteriorated there. We have aquatic vegetation is scarce. There's some standing timber, but most of it is in shallow water. The current regulation there is an 18-inch minimum length limit for largemouth bass, and that was enacted in 1984. At that time, we saw some indications in the population that there were some characteristics that we could, growth characteristics, abundance characteristics that we could, with that regulation, we wanted to increase the density of those largemouth bass and provide anglers a greater opportunity to catch a bass greater than 18 inches. Since then, we've seen few population benefits to the bass population since the 18 inches have been implemented. Over time, angling effort for bass is very low. Not many anglers fishing there, very few bass being harvested. Major problem there is with poor habitat sedimentation and decreasing the volume and available habitat. Looking at the situation there, what we're potentially discussing is reverting back to the 14-inch minimum length limit, which is our statewide regulations. That would simplify the regulations. wouldn't have any impact on the population itself. We've retained the five fish bag, and our staff is looking at some projects there to improve habitat in the reservoir. Next, we have a couple lakes out in West Texas, Fort Phantom Hill and Proctor. Both of these reservoirs are subject to water level changes, as typical of our many West Texas reservoirs, and now we're seeing a lot of that around the state and other parts. We've tried a number of 16-inch minimum length limits for largemouth bass out there. Phantom Hill has had that on since 94, and Proctor was implemented in 2002. And our goals were there to increase the abundance and catch of those bass between the statewide 14-inch minimum and 16 inches. A lot of times we're looking to take advantage of when we have good year classes produced with the rising water levels and see if we could get some better fishing out of those increases. What we've seen over time, abundance and catch rates have varied of those 14, 16-inch bass, but there's few of positives between the pre-regulation and the post-regulation changes. So populations have pretty much remained the same. And what our staff is looking at out there, the ongoing investigation of what are the impacts of the water level changes in time to the bass populations. What we've seen there, we've looked at Fort Phantom Hill for an extended period of time. Through some analysis, we've determined that 92% of the variation in our catch rates in electric fishing of bass, eight inches or less, have resulted or can be correlated to three water level variables. So water levels in certain times of year, and also the water levels from over the winter months. And when we look at bass populations in area lakes with the 14-inch limit under similar water regimes, we see that the populations are responding in a similar fashion. So based on that, we think and no benefits from the 16-inch, we can simplify the regulation there and go back to the 14-inch limit. On Possum Kingdom Reservoir, it's had a tough decade here. Fish populations have been decimated by golden agouts starting in 2001. And when those events were happening, we reduced the statewide bag for striped bass from 5 to 2 with special regulation there. And our goal there was to protect some of the striped bass in the population while providing some harvest for anglers, as striped bass were an important species in Possum Kingdom. Currently, we're still having periodic fish kills there. We still are stocking striped bass. Unfortunately, with those periodic kills, few fish are being harvested, and the bag is really not having any impact on the population structure. So what we're proposing there is going back to the statewide bag of five fish striped bass. That bag's not really having any impact, so we're hoping maybe when we do have an opportunity where we have a number of good years of no golden alga and it does produce some fish, it just will allow the anglers to take those fish. And lake have a new lake, Lake Nacogdoches in Nacogdoches County. It's recently impounded, not a real large reservoir, a little under 700 acres. We've done our typical fish stocking there, stocked some threadfin shad, various other species, including Florida largemouth bass, and that's set to open in angling in 2012. And typically what we do on new reservoirs, we try and implement some regulations to protect that developing fishery. Typically angling effort is high. You have naive fish in there that, and in many cases, can be easily caught, so we usually try and implement some sort of regulations to limit that harvest. And what we want, we have a good, that lake has potential to be a good bass lake, so we want to protect those 14 to 18 inch bass from harvest and ensure that good quality population is established. So what we're proposing there is to implement an 18 inch limit and a five fish bag for largemouth bass, and also additionally we're going to prohibit some of the passive gears there, jug lines, throw lines, strut lines. It's a little smaller reservoir, probably a lot of high use, and some of those things will interfere with some of those activities, and also removing those initially will help some of our catfish populations develop. Last change, we have some potential gear restrictions in state parks. We're having user conflicts in those areas with limited space, such as man-made structures, such as docks, piers, and jetties, people using multiple rods, to sort of dominate that space, prevent use by other people. So we're considering based on State Parks input on that, limiting the number of fishing poles to two, as we do as on our community fishing lake, which are some of our small reservoirs where we have same issues of limited space, and try and allow as many people to fish there as possible. Those are all the changes we're considering at this time. We did discuss all those except the State Park one with our Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Committee, and they give us approval on those changes, and I'd be happy to take any questions at this time if you have any.
Questions for Ken?
I'm just curious, what's the largest number of poles that you've had reported somebody trying to dominate a fishing area?
Well, I've seen people use 15, 20 poles. I'm sure, you know, Gaymores or State Parks have seen more. There is no limit. Well, there's 100 hooks, so you could use quite a few poles to put out, and that does become, you know, if you have limited space, people can certainly dominate that space.
Ken, I've got one question. On Possum Kingdom, there are not many fish right now.
Limit
two. Why don't we raise it back to five? There are not many fish right now anyway.
There's so few fish, you know, being produced. It's really not having any. It's not really, you know, when we do produce some fish, there's so few fish to catch that we really don't see that's having any impact on the population at all. When we do produce, like I said, if we do produce some fish, we might as well have anglers catch them, because there's a good chance, unfortunately, that golden algae is gonna come in and limit that population in the future. So.
Are we looking at any ways to deal with the algae problem and the impact of the salt? As I understand it, the salt, double salt, and the two tributaries of the river are very high in salt. What we might do to work with the Brazos River Authority on water quality, isn't that a big part of the golden algae problem?
Well, we have a number of studies looking at that, and we haven't really gotten any real clear impact there. We've implemented some things on our hatcheries to ameliorate those problems, but on a big system wide basis, we haven't seen anything that's really going to have an impact at this time. So,
I think we ought to. Oh, keep that in mind, because the salinity of that lake, when the salinity levels go up, it seems like the problem for what I've observed over the years. I don't know what you all have seen.
Well, that's we don't, you know, we've spent a lot of time and a lot of research that have looked at that, and we haven't found anything real definitive, and it's something we're going to continue to look at. We'd sure like to solve it and be able to, especially like for Possum Kingdom, get the fishery back to what it was in the past. There, that was a real
water
part
would help.
Yeah, water. Fish got this thing about water; they really need that too. So.
Commissioner, the Brazos River Authority has applied for a system operations permit throughout its entire basin. The TCEQ, kind of the first of its kind that I think we're aware of. We've been very involved over the last few years, working with the Brazos River Authority to try to address inflows, environmental flows, and flow levels at different gauge stations throughout the basin. And so we were able to come to a meeting of the minds on that with BRA. Now that permit is being reviewed by TCEQ, and so we have some folks that have been working very, very directly on this and could probably address some of these issues with respect to salinity regimes and flow regimes. But we've had a very, very good relationship with BRA over the last couple of years, working through this in an in-depth fashion. And I'll get Cindy or Colette to get with you to kind of brief you on that.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Robin Rikers.
Morning, Commissioners. Good morning. Chairman. For the record, my name is Robin Rikers of the Coastal Fisheries Division. And I'm here to present to you today the 2012-2013 coastal fisheries scoping items. The first item I'd like to present will be a clarification of the proclamation regarding take during a freeze event.
And then the second one will be an expansion of seagrass protection through a state scientific area designation. And then lastly, I want to update you on some progress we've made in regards to looking at some recommendations from a workshop that the Hart Institute held in Corpus Christi that was titled Sharing and Conserving Our Bays, and we're looking at those recommendations, and I'll just share with you the progress in that respect. As a reminder, we have the ability to close certain areas during freeze events, with these thermal refuges where fish basically congregate, and we used that authority for the first time last February. That event occurred from February 2nd through the 5th. We put out news releases on the 2nd and 3rd. On the 4th, we had to extend that closure because the cold period was extending for a longer period of time. And in addition, as we did that, of course, we displayed signs at these access points trying to inform people of these closed areas. And, I might also mention, because I believe it was brought up the last time we discussed this, barge traffic also was halted February 3rd in the land cut area in regards to in the ICWW in kind of an informal agreement that we have with that the barge companies in halting that traffic to try to save fish in the ICWW as well, the intercoastal. Obviously, as we went through this and reviewed the first time that we used the closure, we do have a few lessons learned. The first was we had very good coverage of our initial announcement about the closure. Got the news releases out, got it up on the website, and were able to do that fairly well. We did have a little bit of difficulty in our extension as that occurred on Friday when we tried to get that news release out regarding that extension. I can say that basically because there were only about four of us in this building, Carter and Ross and myself and a couple others, it was difficult to get notice out for us. It was also difficult for people who we were trying to have receive that notice because they weren't at their offices as well. This is a place probably where social media will help us in the future as far as getting that word out. And so we're going to find better ways to do that. But we realized that we didn't do as good a job there as we could. Another thing we noticed was at our sites, we're going to try to have some more distinct and better signage so that people can really identify the area and the boundary, and we're working on that to be prepared in case that happens this year. And the last thing, of course, is the clarification of the rule that is actually the rulemaking part of this. And what we would like to do is to clarify the language there in 57975. The language there is in blue, and we want to have it read now: no person shall take or attempt to take any aquatic life by any means in an affected area. Even though dip nets are not a legal take device, people were using dip nets, and we just want to clarify to everyone that during that time, during those areas, we would prefer that you not take any of those fish. Department of State Health Services warns you not to take those fish, and we also would like to go ahead and make sure that people don't do that. I'll pause there, and if anyone has any question about the freeze language, we can have that here, and then I'll go to the next section.
Questions for Robin so far?
The next thing I'd like to talk to you about is expansion of seagrass protection by state scientific area designation. As indicated and brought to you in 2010, we basically redesignated the Redfish Bay State Scientific Area. We visited with you at that time about a lot of the results that we saw in that area. To give you a brief history, of course, of that, that started in 2000 when the area was designated. In 2005, it was renewed. In 2006, we went from a voluntary no-crop zone to a no-uprooting seagrass regulation. And since that time, we've been under that regulation and been monitoring that area. As you may all remember, when we presented this in 2010, we had an extensive education and outreach program in that area trying to make people aware of the regulation. We hit over 10 million impressions, as they call it, where we touched somebody with that message throughout that entire time. Key findings from some of the surveys that we did of people who were using the areas, 85% were aware of the regulation, greater than 85%, and also the greater than 85% actually changed their boating behavior during that time period. Probably most importantly was that we saw a 45% reduction in scarring during that time period. So we actually met the conservation goal that we were trying to meet there. And then another important kind of conservation fact is that we actually saw scar recovery from year to year of 53% and 86%. That is quite a bit higher than the previous literature suggested, where they suggested it would take 7 or 8 years for scar recovery to occur. So we were, that was an important finding for us as well. Lastly, obviously, because this is a rule, there's a law enforcement component as well, and as of August 21st of 2011, there had been 17 citations in the area. 15 were convictions and 2 were pending at that time. So, you know, a lot of success in that story, and that's why you asked us to go find other areas, and that's what we're bringing to you today. When we looked at trying to go forward and figure out where we could expand seagrass protection, we looked to basically create a matrix of things that we would look at in determining which area we should expand this to. And the first was obviously seagrass coverage. Do you have seagrass in the area, and you know, is there seagrass there to protect? Most of the time that occurs in shallow water areas, so that was something we were looking at. Most of the time, if we have damage, it's actually in fairly close proximity to high pressure or high boating access, and so that's where we would look at that as well. The proximity to a Gulf Pass, that's actually a component that we brought in because of the biological nature of seagrass protection of larvae, and it, you get ingress and egress of larvae and small juvenile fish at those Gulf Passes, so that would rate it a little bit higher in regards to needing protection. And then lastly is, did you have scarring in those areas? Are you witnessing issues in those areas that, were identified? We started out with 15 sites. We've narrowed that to these 5 sites you see here: Galveston Island State Park, an area right off of Galveston Island, Christmas Bay, the Matagorda Island Wildlife Management Area, Upper Laguna Madre near the JFK Causeway, and the Mexiquita Flats in South Bay. It's not to say that all of these aren't in need of some protection or in need of us looking at them, but we have narrowed it down to going forward with one item at this point. We're going to go forward with education and efforts of making people aware, and continued efforts with working with partners in the other areas. But our recommendation to you today is that we scope the area near the JFK Causeway. It would encompass about 15,500 acres. It is a heavy traffic area with many access points, and I'll show you that in a moment. It has extensive shallow seagrass flats there. One of the reasons we're choosing this particular area is it is highly, out of the 15,500 acres, there's about 14,000 acres of seagrass that we were able to document with aerial photography. In addition to that, obviously, we have staff in the area who's worked with this protection of seagrass. We've got partners in the area who've already worked with us, and we've had extensive outreach efforts already in that area, so we think we can build on all of that. To show you that proximity and why we believe that proximity will help us in that, the Redfish Bay State Scientific Area is there north. Again, that's 32,000 acres, and the proposed site is down south there, listed as proposed site JFK, 15,500 acres. You see as the crow flies, they're only about 10 miles apart. So a lot of people using the Redfish Bay State Scientific Area may also access this area in their fishing activities, and we think we can you know, utilize that to our benefit in protecting seagrass there. Looking at that area with a little closer up view, you can see that there's a the red dots are access points, boat ramps, and you can see that there to the east of that, there's about 18 miles of developed canals there. There's apparently 8 miles of undeveloped canals over there. And then on the west side, there's about 3 miles of developed canals. So there's a lot of access to this site, but there's also already some marking by TNC and Corpus Christi Bays and Estuary Program have already helped mark some of the ingress and run lanes, if we'll call them. We have to be careful. Some people use a different terminology than we do, but basically the lanes that allow you to get in and out of the area. So, you know, we believe that's certainly a good area where our partners are already trying to do some of that work, and we can help with that. So with that, that's certainly our recommendation regarding extension of the seagrass area or seagrass protection. Obviously, again, what we will have to do is designate it a state scientific area, and we would propose that we scope the no uprooting regulation as we have in the other area. both of the proposals that's mentioned here for this one, but both went to our CRAC on October 5th and were both unanimously supported. If there are any questions about that area or that scoping item, I'll answer those now and then move on to just the briefing portion. Okay. As indicated, there's no formal proposal here, but I did want to take a moment to brief you on our efforts in looking at these recommendations that came out of this workshop that was hosted by the Heart Research Institute, and we were also a partner. Several of the partners just mentioned in the previous presentation were there as partners as well. Again, the notion of that workshop was to get waders, kayakers, hunters, airboat folks, motorboats, anglers, bird watchers all in the same room, especially down in that area, high traffic area, get them all in the same room and talk about how are we going to use and share our bays, basically. They basically came out with workshop results that had over 50 recommendations and 14 best practices. We've created an interdivisional team, coastal fisheries and law enforcement, to look at these and try to group and categorize these. And we've also been asked to, as not necessarily one of their recommendations, but certainly one of the things that came out of that workshop was a discussion about low-impact fishing areas as well. We've been asked to explore that, and we're looking at that. When we discuss that, let me go back. I'm sorry. As far as the 50 recommendation, we first have gone through there and tried to group these things by education and outreach kinds of things, and certainly best practices and that sort of notion is one of those things that may not, it will require a lot of work with Lydia and her shop, but it may not be a regulation or a rulemaking kind of notion. The other thing, a key item that they came out with is expanded seagrass protection, and obviously we're before you today asking to go scope one of those areas, so that was one of the key findings there. And then there were other numerous recommendations, some of which we frankly don't even have authority to do. But, we're trying to go through those and group those and figure out, our team is, which ones of those are plausible and which ones we might be able to move forward with. When we do talk about low-impact fishing areas, as we found in discussing this, there are, just to help everyone be on the same page, at least to what we think we're talking about, is that they are open to all legal methods of fishing. They're typically a lift, drift, pole, and troll type of area, and they, for the most part, we'll have some sort of marked ingress and egress lane that allows people to get in and out of the area. Other considerations that have come up in those discussions is you could have some sort of seasonal component to that low-impact fishing area. You could have it open for boating traffic at some times of the year and maybe closed at others. Another notion is that you could, in that same low-impact notion, you could have some sort of no-wake zone or some sort of minimum idle speed or maximum idle speed that would govern that area. Lastly, as indicated, we're still kind of in the development stage here. We've identified pros and cons. We are identifying some studies that we could do if we if a low-impact fishing area were put into place. We've discussed the concept with a limited number of stakeholders. We've presented the concept really in two separate occasions before our Coastal Resources Advisory Committee, more in general terms because it's been in the context of the presentation of the results of that workshop, and we've agreed to take this back to them at their next meeting and try to come back with some more specifics in regards to what some of these low-impact fishing areas, where they might be, what they might look like. With that, appreciate the opportunity to brief you on that, and certainly will entertain any questions.
Questions, Robin?
Robin, if there was some movement forward on the low-impact fishing areas, would we do it like on a trial basis, say set up a three-year trial and just see how it's working, or 2 year or five, whatever?
Well, certainly we've put sunset provisions just like we had in the other state scientific areas at one point. So there's always the opportunity to put a sunset provision or a date certain when it ends, and you have to take action to extend that. So that certainly is one thing that could be built into that sort of notion, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Robert Goodrich.
Morning, Commissioners. I'm Robert Goodrich, the Assistant Chief of Fisheries Enforcement for the Department. I come before you this morning for a review of potential regulation change. Currently, in fresh water, most of the unattended devices, trot lines and jug lines, all require a gear tag. However, throw lines and minnow traps do not require a gear tag. And as you well know, those devices are left out there. Currently under a gear tag requirement, that tag must contain legibly the name of the person that set it out, their address, and the date it was set out. And then that device can remain with that tag for 30 days. And after 30 days, it must be reviewed and retagged with a new date. And that allows, that provides for that device to be attended out there at some point, and then if need, picked up or retagged and continue to be fished. However, minnow traps and throw lines do not have that requirement. And what happens sometimes is those devices are left out there. And because they are not illegal at that point, because they're not required to be tagged, game wardens cannot pick up the devices. So as you well have heard today about low water situations in many of our lakes and rivers, a lot of those devices like throw lines, which are attached to limbs and to the bank sometimes, they become out of the water. They continue to fish and impact the resource. So what we're proposing is a regulation to require those devices to have a gear tag. And that gear tag can be made out of any durable material, as durable as the line. And, I kind of brought one here today that I could throw together and show you. It can be made out of something as simple as that Coke can right there. You can put all that information on there. It's very durable, and they attach it to the line. And it lets us know who's fishing out there in that, and who's responsible for making sure that those lines are checked and on a 30-day basis. Again, that there's a certain safety amount to that too. Is limb lines, water levels drop. Those are limb lines. Those hooks are dangling there, and people go by in boats or canoes or kayaks. That's a definite little bit of a safety issue. But more than anything, they continue to fish, and they'll pick up, wildlife, animals, and fish when they're not attended. So. That's our review of that potential regulation change. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them at this time.
Questions?
Out of curiosity, what is the present ruling like on crab traps and everything? Do they have that same requirement?
Right, and all of the devices out in saltwater are required to be tagged. And so everything, in fact, even... This is kind of a cleanup because a minnow trap in saltwater is required to have a gear tag, but in freshwater it's not.
That's what I was getting at. So right, this basically just makes everything uniform.
This makes everything uniform. That's an unattended device out there. That's, when someone's fishing with a pole and line, they're usually there, but these devices do remain out there. So this would make all the devices required to be tagged.
Is 30 days magic? I mean, is there any reason that shouldn't be 14 days if the goal is to try to have people check them more frequently?
Well, I know that's always been that way, and I'm not, saying that's consistent with how we should be, but I think when we set it up originally, I looked back in that, and it was like that gave you about 4 weekends in a period of time where people could put devices out on one weekend, and maybe during the course of that month they could come back out in another weekend and run their trot lines. And however, most of the people that do run those do them more often than 30 days. It's just that we found that limb lines, we call them limb lines or throw lines, those tend to just get left and sometimes aren't monitored as well.
If people are checking them more frequently than that, and it's a concern over limb lines, you might look at whether you want to move that time period, shorten that time period.
That's really something we could look at. I know I looked at some other states, and they do that. They have
shorter
2-day periods and 24-hour periods. And
that's more consistent. You wouldn't.
But we can certainly look at that.
What does Louisiana have?
They don't have much regulation.
I was betting
being nice when I said that. I was trying to give our neighbors a little credit.
Oklahoma.
I got a pile of buddies over there. Now, don't worry, I'll tell them the same thing. Don't worry about that. But I was just curious. I was just thinking about the police.
Oklahoma, Kansas, and even up in Ohio, they all require gear tags on everything. And some of them do limit the time.
To Ralph's point, one of the things that you want to keep in mind, I suppose, is the requirement on your staff and monitoring of it. If you give a person a month and you go out and check it, you got to go back, I guess, next month to see if they've taken it off. So, I mean, I don't know what the impact. And again, I'm saying this without knowing what the answer is. I don't know if it's easier on your staff if it's a shorter period of time, or if it's easier on your staff if it's a longer period of time.
Well, I think game wardens are out there all the time, and they're pretty aware of who's fishing those devices, but when they're required to be tagged. So this would bring that back in. We pretty much know who's fishing that body of water, but with lin lines and throw lines, we really don't know because they aren't required to be tagged. This would actually give us more of an identification. And the other part is, too, we can also run that name and address and find out if they have a fishing license. That gives us some more ability, but I'm not sure that shorter period of time, because we pretty much check on that. And when you pulled up somebody's trot line that they put out there, and you've done it once, and they may have gotten a citation, they pretty much don't do that anymore. So it's just having it tagged kind of makes people realize they've put their name out there on the water on a device that's out there, and so they do pay more attention to it.
We don't see an added burden to enforcement. That
no, in fact, you know, this was reviewed by the field.
That's the intent, but is
right. And this recommendation came from the field because they see so many of these throw lines that are left out there, and it was reviewed by staff and the field, and they all supported it.
Chairman,
what constitutes a throw line? What's the definition of a throw line?
Well, the definition is a line with five or less hooks attached at one end to a fixed object at one end. So it's going to be five or less hooks, and it have the line, and it's going to be attached at one end. If it was attached at both ends, it becomes a trot line. Right.
What if it has more than five hooks?
It's not legal.
Okay.
And if this were to pass and you find a throw line that's not tagged, do you have the right to cut the thing and remove it?
Right. That's part of the thing. In the Parks and Wildlife Code, by statute, we have the ability to seize illegal fishing devices. But this would make it illegal when it's not tagged. And that's what we do with trot lines and jug lines that we find out there that either untagged or out of date. We will seize those, and there's a process of destruction that we have to go through where we put it up at the courthouse for 10 days, where it was seized, the location, and then the county judge issues an order, and the materials are destroyed. So there's a process that we go through, but we haven't been able to do that with throw lines and mini traps.
I'm following up on Ralph. It'd be interesting to know what other states do as far as time frame. Limb lines.
Right.
Somebody will check that in 30 days. It's long abandoned. It makes sense to have the ability to require people to check it more often.
I know I checked into like one there in Ohio. They have 2 days. And another had 24 hours. So there are some differences. I can sure look into that.
Just see if 2 weeks works.
If a throw line and trot line don't make sense.
Right, and throw lines aren't legal on salt water. So they can't use them down there. But I can sure check into that.
If we could do that for the PMRC, come back a little bit.
Correct.
More information and some benchmarking, I think that'd be helpful. That's great.
But the banded ones they tie to a limb and leave in the river.
Well, you know, like there's two points. I mean, if somebody's fishing, yes, doing this, if they left it a week or 2 weeks, then they've on it, it's dead and eaten up by something else, right? So what's common sense.
Yeah, I think they're going to be more of a trend not to leave it if they have their name attached to it.
Sure, he's
monitor it.
I've got one clarification question. Now, if somebody leaves it out over 30 days and you seize the whatever it is, trot line, whatever you're seizing, does the person who has the tackle, they're also get a citation for that, or you just destroy them?
Well, we will contact them about that it's left out there, and you know, as a process, it becomes evidence in the case, and we will go forward with the investigation. So oftentimes they do get a citation. Because, as I said, usually the warden, once he sees all these tags out there, he knows who's fishing in the area, and he'll contact that person and let them know that you've got a device out here that we've seized. And so, but it is an evidentiary process, and, of course, you know, we have to prove that that device is being fished by them. And again, you've just got somebody's name hanging on there. It gets a little tough on proving that they were actually fishing it. But we do contact them, and a lot of times they'll, I didn't tag it, and you know, well, that's a citation. And if we issue them a citation and they take care of it in court, we return the fishing lines to them.
Thank you, Robert. Appreciate it. Okay, it's the end of item 7. The committee has completed its business.